All right, so we've been looking at the question of, does baptism wash away adultery? And as I mentioned at the beginning, we're going to take a slow approach to this. And so over the last couple of weeks, we were looking at the need for us to understand what baptism is and what it is not. And so we spent a couple of weeks looking at that, and so I invite you to go back if you weren't able to be here to look at those studies as far as baptism goes. But as we think about it, baptism is our way into Christ, it's our way into the church, it's our way into forgiveness, and it is the way in which our sins are washed away. If you go to 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9 and following, 9 and 10, he has a long list of some sins that were being committed formally by the Corinthian Christians. But what does he say in verse 11? 1 Corinthians 6, 11, he says, "But which were some of you, but you've been what? You've been washed." Referring back to their baptism. So in their baptism, it allowed them to attain God's forgiveness by the blood of Jesus Christ. And it's not, again, not the water, right, that washes your sin away, but it is the act of obedience, which allows us to get to Jesus, and it's his blood that washes our sins away. So, moving forward, so we need to understand baptism. We also need to understand, in answering this question, marriage. And we'll see if we can get through all of this today. But I want to look at it in a few different ways. I want to go back to the beginning. We need to understand marriage as God established it in the garden. So looking at what God said in the garden, let's go back to Genesis chapter 1. In Genesis chapter 2. These are the two texts we're going to look at for just a minute. These are fresh in my mind. We've been trying to memorize these with the boys, but in particular 26 and 27. But as you may remember, this is God reaching the pinnacle of creation where he's actually going to create mankind. And so if you go back to verse 26, the text says, Then God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the livestock, over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, or the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And so God gets to the point, he's ready to create man, and in chapter 1, 26 and 27, you have an abbreviated summary of what he'll get into detail in chapter 2. And it's in chapter 2, as he revisits man's creation in particular, that God gives us a little extra detail, doesn't he? If you go just one chapter over, you may remember the first part of Genesis chapter 2 gives us a little bit of a description of the world in which man has been placed into. And then after forming man, verse 7 says, "Then the Lord formed the man from the dust of the ground, then and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living creature." And so for a short period of time, you have Adam created, and he hasn't gotten to the part where he creates Eve. And as you continue reading, what's kind of the point? As God is showing man all that's around him, he ends up bringing the animals to him, and Adam names all the animals. But what does Adam not find in any of those animals? What? Yeah. He needs a helper. There's no fit companion for him. None of those animals can feel that need for him. God created us as social beings. We're not intended to be alone, but there's that desire in us for companionship. And so as you get down to verse 15, I see, he puts him in the garden. He begins to work. Verse 18, God says, it's not good that man should be alone. I will what? Make a helper fit for him. What's that idea of fit mean to you?
Complete him.
To complete him.
That's what came to mind.
Okay. You may want to add that. What you get any other translations there? Helper. The English Standard has fit. Any other different translations of that phrase? That's verse number 19.
18.
I'm sorry, 18. You're right.
Fit me for him?
Yes. No, it says a helper fit for him.
Comparable in the New King James.
Comparable in the New King James. Yes. Anybody have a different word?
I have
comparable. Comparable too. So when you think about those ideas, fit, comparable, well, what do you think he's trying to get across to us?
We need each other.
We need each other.
Similar.
Similar, right? There's a comparable, right? That idea of comparable. I think of the idea, this is my mind. I always fit, what comes to my mind is you think of a jigsaw puzzle, right? And the pieces what? Fit together. If you get the wrong two pieces trying to fit them together, is it going to work? No, but when you find the one that matches, right, there is that perfect fit. Yes, ma'am. Okay. And also, I don't want to take this illusion too far, but in a jigsaw puzzle, does all the pieces look identical?
No.
No, they're different, right? But yet seemingly they fit together because they're just cut perfectly. Men and women, are they exactly the same? No, they're not. But they fit together. They are comparable. They match together. They work together as God intended. And so he says, I'm going to make a fit companion for you. Verse 19, now out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field, every bird of the air, and brought them to man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all the livestock and to the birds of the air and to the birds of the heavens. I keep saying air. And to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not a helper fit for him. So the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon man. And while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord had taken from man, he made into a woman and brought her to man. Now, before we get into the next part of that, I think it's interesting that God brings all the animals to man. I can't get wholly in God's mind, but what might be a reason God wants Adam to go through meeting all of these animals? Okay, I think that's good. Any other idea? And it's interesting, at this point, Adam has no experience with any other human being. It's just him. So he has no background of experience of what it means to be in a companionship with another human being. He is it. So the only experience he has thus far is with God and with God's created world. So I think that's kind of interesting. And after going through all of that, there's still something missing. And do you think it's that God doesn't understand something's missing?
He wanted Adam to understand.
Yeah. It's not that God lacks this understanding. I think this is for Adam's benefit, that he needs to realize there's something missing here. And so it's at that point that God then puts him in anesthesia. God has his own form of anesthesia. He puts him under, and while he sleeps, he takes that rib. This is also another thing that's fascinating to me. God doesn't say, okay, Adam, here we go. You go over there and watch, and I'm going to take some more clay, and I'm going to form another being here, and I'm going to breathe into them. He could have done that, right? But why does he take the rib and not just the dirt, the clay? Okay.
Brother, while I'm talking, I would just like to comment that you asked, I forgot the question that you asked, but what came to mind is God wanted Adam to build a relationship with him first. And I think that could, and the reason why I say that is this. Yes, God wanted Adam to feel that he needed someone. But he created that helper that fit for him a little later. And I'm thinking of this because for a long time, I was filling the space that God wanted to have in my life with the man, a man. Mm-hmm. Okay? And church, I want to tell you, that doesn't work if God is not filling that void first.
Yes,
if you are not seeking him first, going after something else that God has created, doesn't work. Whether it's money, well, for me it was another man, you know. You got to have a man, Gina. But I realized that, and after I realized that God created me for him first, even though I came from the rib of a man, I need to fit God. Put God on the throne of my life first.
That's a good point. And I think one of the ideas here too is each of those, so in Adam's life, he ends up having three different types of relationships. Okay? So he has his relationship with Eve. They have their own unique relationship. He has another relationship with the rest of creation, which is its own kind of unique relationship. But ultimately, he has a unique relationship with God. And we have a different relationship with God than we do any of those others. It's a different one. And maybe it was, I don't know, maybe it was that God needed him to see, you need to have a relationship with me first, and then it will help those other two relationships in a very significant way. And you're right, animals cannot feel that relationship with God or anything else in creation, nor can a spouse feel that relationship. That's a unique need, the spouse relationship, but so is our relationship with God, and only he can feel that. Charlene and then Becky.
I think that when you ask the question, why did God create Adam, we think he took instead of the dirt, it's because man innately has self-preservation. That's a part of us, to protect ourselves. And when we take something that's from us and make something else from us, there's an automatic attachment, like a mother to a child. there is an automatic attachment, because that's, he says bone on my bone.
Yeah, so he goes right into that.
That's a part of him that he's going to automatically feel attached to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what my thought process is.
And that's different than anything else in creation, right? She stands out very unique to him than anything else in his life in created world. And so, yeah. So, good response, Becky.
I guess I was just saying that not every union between every man and woman has ever been what is by, because of the choice, has not been what God meant. But when mm-hmm. God means the help meet for Adam, if God's ultimately desire for man is to have a relationship with him, which I believe it is, then that's what he meant by help meet. Because he doesn't care that the woman can help him go pick berries, or he doesn't care that the woman can fulfill some desires that he may have. He cares that the woman can help him and that he can help her have a better relationship with him.
Ultimately, that's what you hope. Of course, like you say,
most marriages
don't, unfortunately, aren't reaching that. But that would be the idea, right? Is that you're both striving toward God. But again, that relationship with God is unique, because you see it. I mean, in marriages where one spouse is a Christian, the other isn't. Right, that still that spouse that's a Christian is still striving for that direction. But when you have two who work together for that common goal, they can be much more fruitful for God. Yes.
I was just going to say, sometimes I know I forget sometimes that when God was bringing these animals to Adam to name, there were two of them
mm-hmm.
of each kind, and after a while he had to think. You know, start looking around. So, okay, where's my other?
Yeah, I'm just a third wheel here.
So, you know, that had to occur to me.
Yeah.
You know, and so God, of course, knew what was going on, and you know, kind of, hey, don't worry. You know, I'm just hiding it from you or something.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever hung out with friends, married friends, and you're single, right? How fun is that? Let's all go out to eat dinner or go to a movie together.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just, you feel a little bit awkward. Why? Well, it's kind of natural. Right? They have their own unique relationship. You're not a part of that. And so you want to go out and form your own unique relationship. Then the four of you can get together and maybe it's a little different. But yeah, absolutely. So Ms. Charlene kind of already alluded to this, but let's go back to our reading, and we'll see man's response to what God has done. So, verse 21, he takes the rib, he forms Eve. Verse 22, the rib that the Lord had taken from man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Now, notice his response. He didn't have this with any other created being that God brought to him, but when he sees her, what's his response? This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she is taken out of man. Now, we got into a little bit of a discussion about this in our Thursday class. I'll just allude to what we were talking about. But so there's really two elements to our being under consideration. The woman, as far as her spirit goes, is a unique being. Right? She has her own unique soul. She ultimately has her own unique destiny as regards to God, as far as eternity goes. But then there is that fleshly part that has a deep connection to one another. And so while we live in this world, we walk side by side in this unique fleshly way. Now, as Jesus will let us know, in heaven, things won't be exactly the same. Because in heaven, what will be like the angels in what way?
They're not given marriage.
Yeah, so we won't. But while on this earth, we form these unique bonds with one another. Paul says that you become what? One flesh with one another. So, thinking about this, there are four words that I want to share with you. Four words from the text here. Number one is the word unique. The relationship, again, between man and woman is a unique one. Unlike any of the other created beings God had made, man and woman have a unique, special relationship. That's important. Put that away for later on. So, we have two dogs at home, and I love them both. We've had other dogs in the past. You maybe have had lots of pets in your life. Can we trade out pets and everything's okay? Maybe not emotionally. I'm not trying to get into your emotional feels, right? But, pets come and go. Things come and go. But with a man and a wife, we can't just trade out. All right? Just because you don't like the one you got in the moment, you can't just go and take them back and to their parents and say, here you go, I want to try somebody different. Right? That's a uniquely bonded relationship. Just keep that away. We'll come back to that idea, that concept. But number one is the idea of unique. Number two is untied. And that may seem like, what do you mean untied? Untied to one another? What I mean is no other ties. You're not tied to any other person. Adam and Eve are tied to one another, and even more so than their children, right? Your children do not have the same tie with you that your spouse does. One day, what's going to happen? They're going to move out, and for many of our children, they're going to find someone else to tie themselves to. Now, some of us get really excited when they finally get to that point and move out. But they're going to go form a bond with somebody else, and it's going to be unique in its own way and different than the one we have. And that may be hard for some of us to take, but that's the natural order of things. They're untied to everything else. Their number one bond is to one another. Number three, they're united. Okay, untied, but united to one another. And what is really special about Adam and Eve and their relationship with one another is that they're bonded by God. You've probably heard this, but in any marriage, it's a triangle of relationship. You have a bonding with one another, but you also are bound by God in this marriage. Marriage is God's institution. Now, I know this gets backward in our culture, and we think marriage belongs to the government. The government does not own marriage. It did not start marriage. It did not establish it. It is not its institution. I know they give us a piece of paper and they stamp it and all that stuff. It does not belong to them. Marriage is God's institution. And God gets to establish the rules for it and the way it is bonded. And then finally, unit. They are one flesh. They are bound together as one. What did Adam say when he saw Eve? This is what? Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, right? They are uniquely formed, fitted, comparable to one another. So as we look back at the garden, I think that is God establishes his covenant. I think that those are some of the ideals that come out to me. I had another thought. You think about marriage. Marriage is the first human interaction that God sanctions. Marriage, the marriage covenant is God's second covenant with man. His first covenant, of course, being his law with man. He instructs man on what he expects. And then secondly, it is marriage. I think it's fascinating that marriage is the instrument with which Paul compares Jesus' relationship to us. Jesus' relationship in the church is comparable to marriage. Ephesians chapter 5, go back and read that. That text is not about marriage. It's about the church. And he's using marriage to talk about the relationship the church has to Jesus. It's very instructive in marriage. I'm not getting me wrong, but that's not... marriage was the understood fact. It was being used as a way to describe the church's relationship to Jesus. And so those four ideas, four words stand out in that text. So, any other thing with God in the garden? All right, let's go to the next place. Let's talk about Moses in Moab. Moses in Moab. Let's go, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 24. Let's understand what Moses actually has to say here. A lot of assumptions get made. Maybe are not true. Moses in Moab. All right, so Deuteronomy 24 is in the context, the greater context of what is being described. The law of Moses, right? The law given by Moses, mediated by Moses from God. All right, let's go to verse 24:1. Somebody read 1 through 4, please, nice and loudly.
When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her, and write her a bill of divorcement, and giveth it in her hand, and sendeth her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that, she is defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance.
Wow.
Okay, so kind of tough, isn't it? Tough writing there. I think one thing that's kind of unfortunate is there's some assumptions made about this text that are not correct. Let's go back and look at the text. All right, so let's see what he says. Number one, you'll notice the word if, right? What's if entail to you?
It's condition.
All right, it's conditional. So what's the condition under description in this text? Okay. I think it's a little more than that. He's not just suspicious. Notice what he says, and has found. What's he describing? What has he found? He's found a sin in her. He's found a sin. Now, he says that later on in the text. If you go down to verse 4, he says what? After she has been defiled. In regards to marriage, what defiles one spouse or the other?
Fornication.
Well, even more accurately, is adultery. You may remember that. Fornication describes a broad spectrum of sin, whereas adultery is a specific type of sexual sin. Adultery, so all adultery is fornication, but not all fornication is adultery. So those are not synonymous. Fornication is the much broader group of sin. Adultery is directed at marital sin. What has happened to her? Why is he allowed to give her a writ of divorce? Because she has committed adultery. That's why he's allowed to put her away. Unfortunately, later on in Matthew 19, the scribes get this mixed up. They actually say it wrong. Jesus in the moment doesn't correct them. They should have known. But notice it's conditional. He can put her away if what? If he has found indecency or sin in her. So number one, the assumption of what Moses taught is wrong. Yes, ma'am. Well, when you're,
there's a big jump between being naked and being fornicated.
Right? No, I don't think it is, because he says indecency. Later on, he says sin, right? He calls it sin in verse 4. He should not take her back. She has been defiled, right? For that is an abomination. And you shall not what? Bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance. And so again, what kind of shame would she create but adultery? And so
with the first husband, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The former husband, I was thinking that defiling was marrying the second husband.
No, because that comes only after the writ of divorce.
But it's talking about taking her back to
the first husband. Yeah, he can't take her back because she defiled, committed adultery against him. No, I don't think so. I think because it says he gives her a right of certificate and puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house and she departs. And if she goes, notice that she goes and becomes another man's wife. So to me, that is a act after. No, I think the defilement occurred, then she's given a writ of divorce and sent away. That the defilement comes in verse 1, the second husband doesn't come until later, after the writ of divorce. That's a post act.
So this is saying if a wife cheats on a husband, mm-hmm. the husband cannot take her back?
Mm-hmm. That's what it's saying.
If she got married,
if she remarried, after she,
and that's what I said, if he divorces her.
If he divorces her, he cannot take her back.
Whether she remarries or not.
Whether she's married or not, he cannot take her back. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If you go ahead, yes, ma'am.
So just the term of lewdness, I think it was written somewhere, I think mm-hmm.
What is uncleanliness?
Yes.
It's sin, right? And in a marriage context, what sin is under discussion? It's adultery, right? Because if she goes out and lies to her neighbor, that's a sin. Is that a cause for divorce? No. That wouldn't be a cause for divorce because he'd be in trouble too, right? We're all sinners. This is specific to marriage. When in the marriage context, what sin is specific to marriage? Adultery.
So this is actually saying if the man divorces her, or even if he dies, which if the husband dies, you're certainly not married to him anymore, the first husband cannot take her back.
Mm-hmm. So, and if you understand it, you disagree with my interpretation of that, you can... please continue to study it. But that's after looking at it, that's my view of what's going on there. So so you have adultery being brought into the marriage and God giving a break to that marriage. He's breaking the bonding there by allowing it by condition. Okay, so Moses' teaching is based on a series of conditions, just like you find in the New Testament. Let's go to Romans chapter 7. You also notice here Paul speaking about marriage. Romans chapter 7, verse 1. Let's read verses 1 through 3. Or do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to those who know the law. Notice what he's talking about. Those who know the law. That the law is binding on a person only as long as he lives. For a married woman is bound by the law of her husband while he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, he is free from that law. And if she marries another man, she is not an adulteress. And so death was a condition that would free one to freely marry someone else. Again, but it's... one of the big ideas here is that Moses is not commanding divorce. Divorce only comes as a condition of the behavior of the two spouses toward one another. And if adultery is committed, that breaks that bond so that the one who has not committed adultery is free to marry another, but the other one has to do what? It has to stay single. And is not given that right to go and marry another, but she is bound by her husband, or he is bound by her, depending on who does the committing of adultery. And so you look back at Moses. Is Moses teaching anything that's in contradiction to what God taught in Genesis chapter 2? I do not believe so. Moses is not contradicting God, which sometimes gets, I think, implied, if not taught outrightly. Yes, ma'am.
But if she's the one that was the adulterer, and Moses is allowing her to be married again, how does that work?
So he gives this allowance in the law of Moses for her to go. So if he's allowing for the husband to break the marriage bond with her, right? In this situation, she's committed adultery. Now, if she goes and do that, he gives her an opportunity to then go and marry another man, but she would be under the same obligation to not commit adultery again. And to form that new bond.
I think the context is not saying that she's okay to marry. It's the context is, can the husband take her back?
Yeah. Maybe I said that wrong.
It's not giving her permission to go marry.
Yeah, so go back. Go back to Deuteronomy 24. That's...
But in the same verse 2, she may go.
Let's see. So he gives her the certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her out of his house, and she departs. And if she goes and goes and becomes another man's wife, is he saying that's okay?
The King James doesn't say if she goes.
He says she may go.
If she may go, that's still conditional. But does it say if she marries another?
No, she can. She can go marry another. And period. And then it has a period.
Hold on just a second. The New King James, does it have the word if in it?
Not in verse 2. Verse 2 says, when she has departed from his spouse and goes and becomes another man's wife.
So it doesn't give any kind of indication one way or the other.
Yeah, but I will read this as give she getting any permission.
Well, that's my, yeah, that's kind of my point is, and maybe I'm chasing that rabbit there with the word if. Yeah, I don't think that's important. I guess I'm trying to look at the word she may or can as if God is allowing it. So that's what I was just trying to look at. Give me just 1 second, sorry. And so this is the New King James Version. It says, when she departed from his house and goes and marries another. All right, again, that's not allowing permission. That's New King James. The King James here, or this is the American Standard. It says, and when she's departed out of the house, and she may go and marry another man's wife, or be another man's wife. All right, that's the American Standard. And then I was trying to, I know I've got a King James, I thought. Oh, there it is, King James. And the King James would say, and if the latter, let's see, wait, back up. Verse 2. And when she is departed out of the house, she may go and be another man's wife. I think the may go is that's, she may go and do that. But I don't think God is saying, you may go do that. Yeah, you know, that's, you say that differently. I don't think God is giving her permission. That's a good point by Vance. He's not saying you can go and marry another. That's okay. That's just what she may do as an adulteress. In other words, he's not giving her permission to go and do that. And so, and also looking at the first husband who was married to her, why is he not taking her back? Why can he not take her back? Well, he's went and been bonded with somebody else, so he can't go in and just put her away and take back the first wife.
Mm-hmm. Where does it say she got married, he got married to somebody else?
He got married again. It's talked about him, she gets divorced again, and he can't go back and remarry her.
And in verse 4, it says may not be again his wife, and now we're saying that means he's given permission or not given permission.
The NET, which I'm not my favorite mm-hmm. thing, but it's in verse 4, it says, her first husband who divorced her is not permitted to remarry her after she has become ritually impure.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that put a little bit different spin on it. In other words, she evidently was impure in their marriage, and then she went into a marriage she shouldn't have been in, which would have made the second marriage impure. Ritual means more than once. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I didn't see that in the other versions, but I don't know.
You're right. So let me back up. Let me say, all right, so I don't know what the first husband's doing. He cannot then go into, he's basically saying, because she's been defiled, because she has broken that bond with adultery, he cannot then go and take her back, whether he's been married or not. So I'm sorry I said that. But he is not given permission by God to go and remarry her. Ooh, we're early on that bell, aren't we? Oh, no, we're not. We're way late. Sorry, I got into that. But anyway, let me step back. The big point here is what Moses is saying is not in defiance of what's in Genesis chapter 2, where God binds a husband and wife together. Only God can break that marriage. God has said the only thing that can break that marriage is adultery. What Moses is saying is that when that marriage has been broken, he cannot just go and take her back when she's committed adultery from him. He's not allowed to take her back later on, even if that former or that latter husband were to divorce her as well. He can't do that. But it doesn't change what's in Genesis chapter 2. It does not change what is in Matthew 19, which I believe is part of the misunderstanding of the Pharisees in Matthew 19. We'll talk about that next week. And then later by what Paul writes. So that's the big point that I think is being taught here is there is no difference. All right, I'm way over time. Sorry about that. Good discussion. We'll come back and look at Jesus next week. Thank you.